Hello and welcome back to the 7 Minutes Podcast, episode 4 of whatever season we're on. I've lost count.
3, I think.
Yeah, I think it's 3. I'm Zach, going counterclockwise around the table and introducing themselves. We have...
It's me. It is I, Angela.
Nailed it.
Robert here.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Dominic here.
Yeah, that's all 4 of us. So, since we last recorded, about a month has gone by. And you know what that means? There's a lot of game time. So let's talk about what all we've been playing in the month since. Angela, why don't you start us off?
Okay. Still haven't beaten Metroid, but I was continuing to play it. And then I don't exactly know what stopped me from continuing.
Mario Kart Tour.
Well, yeah, there's that. But I do intend to finish Metroid very soon because I was... enjoying it. But tonight I actually had planned to start finally getting into Kirby's Return to Dream Land Deluxe. It's been sitting in my pile of games to play. And I feel like I finally have some time to jump into it. So looking forward to starting that one hopefully tonight. And otherwise, I've actually been playing a lot of Smash lately. I just got this urge to just really wanted to play it. So I've been playing a lot of Smash on Smash Bros. On Switch. And same with Mario Kart. I just was having a lot of fun with all the, what is it called again? The wave.
The DLC.
Yeah.
Booster course pass.
Thank you. Yeah, the booster course pass. I've been having a lot of fun with those tracks. So I've been playing a lot of Smash Bros. And Mario Kart 8 on the Switch lately. But yeah, so looking forward to jumping into Kirby tonight, though.
Cool. A lot of old favorites that have come up in previous, what have you been playing segments?
Yeah. And then, what I intended to do last night, but I got distracted. Zach and I have a free company house with our friend in Final Fantasy 14. But if you don't log in for a long enough period of time, there's the risk of your house getting demolished. So Zach logged in, made sure to play long enough last night.
Yeah, we got a notification email.
Yeah, that our house was saved from demolition again. But I actually have not decorated my room in our free company house. So
yeah,
want to get around to doing that sometime this week too.
I don't know how much the real life / Animal Crossing happy home designer skills are going to translate to Final Fantasy 14, but we'll see.
Yeah. I don't have any furniture at all. So, but Zach said he can help me with that.
At the acquisition of furniture, if not the arrangement of furniture.
Yeah.
The layout stuff for your rooms in Final Fantasy 14 it's a pretty awkward system.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sure I'll get used to it.
If there's more customizability than you get in Animal Crossing, mm-hmm. but what you get in exchange is something that's kind of a little finicky to put together.
Oh, okay. Well, still looking forward to it, because some of my time lately has actually been taken up by real life happy home designing in our own home. We actually just bought a vintage Wedgwood stove today. A neighbor was selling it for a very reasonable price, so I jumped on it.
Yeah, hopefully it works. We'll find out soon.
Yeah, they claim that it's been working all the way up to the last couple of months, so they've been using it for the 6 years that they owned it. So that was exciting. Then we got some new blinds for our dining room, new curtains for the living room. So I've been doing a lot of, like I said, real life happy home designing that's kind of cut into some of my game time.
Do you feel like the skills translate?
They actually do translate, especially because like with Animal Crossing New Horizons, they put a lot of effort and frankly, I think a lot of love and care into all the different light fixtures and furniture and accessories that you can put into your house. Like you could tell that the designers and the devs who are actually responsible for designing those individual items for your home, they're definitely looking at what's popular right now mm-hmm. in homes and then putting that into the game. So like a lot of like light fixtures that I'm looking at right now for our dining room and for our kitchen, I'm like, oh, yeah, I have something similar in Animal Crossing. So, yeah, it is helpful. I think that's also why I enjoy doing it in real life, because
yeah.
I love doing it in Animal Crossing.
Do you move everything square by square?
I try. But yeah, so that's what I've been playing.
Cool. Robert, how about you?
I've kind of been playing stuff. I've been a little distracted. Up until about almost a month ago, I was playing Final Fantasy VII. Was it Rebirth?
Remake.
Quite a bit. I didn't play it when it originally came out. So I technically could play the PS5 version, but I'm a traditionalist. I want to experience it on the PS4. So I have it in my Pro. That's what I've been playing it on. It's very, 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 very good.
How far are you?
I am about to do the Don Cornejo stuff.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So you got to Wall Market?
Mm-hmm. I've been doing every single side quest, though. So I've been padding out the experience.
I found that kind of weighed on me when I got to Wall Market. I feel like that chapter was like the most tedious on replay, even though like it's cool. There's a lot of cool stuff that happens there. But I kind of like by the time that's over, like I'm so excited to get to
Agreed.
More of the game.
Plus, I was so damn tired of that Wall Market song.
That one?
Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I felt a little overwhelmed when I got to that section because it felt like there was so much that I didn't want to miss. So, like, I kind of came to a stop. But the bigger problem is I'm a diabetic and I have not been going to the gym for, like, 2 months because I had some health issues going on. So I finally started going back to the gym, and I've gone to the gym every single day for the past 3 weeks. So, like, I haven't had a ton of time to play, so that's been cutting into it. But
I've been going with Robert, which I hadn't really thought about until just now, is, I think, cutting into some of my time.
I'm trying to think if I've been playing anything else. I am continuing to pick away at Crisis Core as well on my Switch. I think it's interesting because, like, you know, you go from Final Fantasy VII, the original, with the turn-based, you know, mechanics. Crisis Core is more action focused, and I feel like they took like the basics of that combat system from Crisis Core, which I enjoy, but it's so much better in Remake. Like, it's like a much beefier, better version of what they did in Crisis Core. But Crisis Core is fun. Kind of wish they'd find a way to bring 7 to Switch, but it'll probably never happen. But
it's not on Switch?
The Remake isn't.
That's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Like, give it up.
You know, it's one last thing on Remake. I think it's pretty impressive how, I mean, the pre-rendered backgrounds in the original 7 are beautiful and they're full of detail, but, like, the guys at Square who put together Remake are insane. Like, there's so much detail everywhere that you go, and it's like they took what was in your brain, like your imagined version of that fantasy world, and actually rendered all of it. I mean, like, what sector is Aerith in? Is it 5, I think, that she lives in?
Sector 5 slums is where the church is.
Well, that whole sector, like, that she lives in, it's just, like, when you're going through, it's just amazing. And then you get to the point where her house is with the water. Like, it's just really incredible. But I think from a storytelling perspective, you know, I don't care if there's spoilers. It was years ago that it came out now. They still crush Sector 7. Like, the plate comes down.
The plate comes down.
So, like, I'm just thinking how the effectiveness of fleshing out the game world the way that they did for the remake, like, I'm just imagining that when they finally do crush that sector, it's going to feel way more powerful from a storytelling perspective than it even did in 7. Because it's like you truly got to walk around and explore that area in more detail, I feel like, than in the original. So that's pretty neat from a narrative standpoint.
You're just imagining it's going to be that way.
Well, I mean, because it was just coming to my head because I'm like, I know the basics of the story of the original game. So I'm like, you know, I remember, you know, when the plate came down, like, it felt impactful, but I'm just thinking, I'm here running around, there's all these people that you're talking to, like, each place feels more fully realized, so, like, your emotional investment is that much stronger, I think. But then I also wonder if part of it, too, is because I can look back at the original game, and it's maybe more emotionally impactful for me. Like, if somebody played 7 Remake with no experience of the previous game, I wonder if they'd feel the same. But for me, it was really amazing stuff. And then I'm trying to think of anything else. I guess I haven't really played too much beyond that. I'm sure I'll think of something later. For now, I'll say that's it. That's it.
All right. Dom, I think you and I have been doing a little more gaming than that.
Yeah, so since last time recorded, the last game I played was RE4 Remake. I still haven't touched Mercenaries. I haven't gone back to it at all. But since then, I've beaten the original Final Fantasy. Mm-hmm. I purchased it on the PS5, the Pixel Remaster. I didn't buy the whole collection. I just bought it. I just bought the single Final Fantasy 1. Mm-hmm. And that was my first time playing the game. The only other Final Fantasy game I'd ever played through completely was Final Fantasy 7, not the remake.
Yeah.
And so playing it was awesome. I really see what the hype was about from the music to sort of the combat style. I really love pretty much every part of it. Some of the stuff really felt like this is an NES game, like some, you know, sort of the non-guidance aspect of it. There were a couple times I had to refer to a guide because I just had no idea where I was supposed to go. And then once I read, I'm like, wow, how was I supposed to know that? Yeah. You know, like there's this one part where you have to go to the desert to find this person selling an item.
Oh yeah.
And so there are hints throughout the game if you talk to the characters, and they're like, yeah, it's on a patch in the sand dunes or in the desert. And I'm just going crazy looking for this thing. I probably spent like an hour and I just couldn't figure it out. And so I finally read online that it's a discolored square in the desert. You just move your character there and he goes into like the world where you're supposed to go. So like little things like that kind of frustrated me, but I guess it's just, you know, because of the time, you know, we talk about Zelda sometimes, the original Zelda. I think last episode, you know, we were talking about how do you know to bomb these walls and just one of the things. But the music's great. And then, like I was saying, the battle system's good. I like how they did the magic and spells. Like
the slot system?
Yeah, so the slot system and the fact that you sort of had MP per magic level.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really well done. And I don't know if, you know, future Final Fantasy games are like that. I know 7 wasn't exactly like that at all, but...
Yeah, I think that's... I think that might be the only one that works like that. Maybe 3 works like that, actually, but at least after that, they go to just MP.
Are you guys familiar with that, what I'm talking about, or...?
The slot system?
Not the slot system, but like every... So there's like 7 levels of magic, and each level they have an MP amount. So like you'll have 5 in level 1 or 4 in level 3. And it's almost like you could you can use any spell in that level that many times. Each level has their own MP counter. It's hard to explain. Unless
I have not played the original Final Fantasy, so I'm not familiar.
Yeah, and I don't think... Because I've played 7, basically to the end, and I don't remember that being.
It works. Yeah, it's not like that in 7. Yeah. This works kind of similarly to Dungeons and Dragons, where like a wizard or a cleric has like per day they can cast this many level 1 spells and this many level 2 spells and this many level 3 spells. So like if a cleric goes to cast, they can choose any of their level 3 spells, but it takes one of those level 3.
So basically like PP for a Pokemon move.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Okay.
But it's for a set of spells rather than for individual moves.
Okay.
Yeah. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that a lot. And then as far as like my party, I just went with the default. I did the warrior, the thief, the black mage, and the white mage.
You know, back in the day on the NES, the default was warrior, fighter, thief, black belt, and red mage.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually... Like reading a Nintendo Power guide that was giving you a rundown on like different potential party combinations, called that one the default party.
Mm.
And I was like, the hell does default mean? Because I'm like, you know,
oh my goodness, yeah.
I'm like 9 at the time. So I didn't know that it just meant like just click A a bunch of times and that's the party you get. I was like, oh, how fancy in French. Yeah.
The default.
Yeah. So, if I were to play it again, I kind of have a set in my mind of who I'd want to keep and who I'd probably get rid of. The thief would be the first to go, in my opinion. But I probably would never touch that game again. Mm-hmm. I got the story. I got my joy out of it.
Yeah.
It's funny, though. I was looking through the trophy list on it, and it mentioned something called the Excalibur. Do you know what that is?
Oh, yeah, yeah. In So you go through the Mirage Tower to get to like the Sky Fortress or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in the Sky Fortress, there's a treasure called Adamant. Like a key item. If you take that to the Smith Kokol, who lives in the Dwarven village, he can turn that into the sword Excalibur, which is a super powerful sword that only the warrior can use.
So it's a weapon. I figured it was a weapon.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought I did everything.
It's still not as powerful as the Masamune, which you can find in the last dungeon.
That's what I have, yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah, so I beat that, and then... I sort of bounced around a couple of games. One that I was really committed on playing through finally was Disco Elysium.
Mm.
Mm, is that good?
So I played a few hours, and I have to say it's excellent. Like, the voice acting is great. And just the unique play style of the game. Mm-hmm. I've never seen anything really like that. Mm-hmm. The only problem is I generally play games at night, and it's very dialogue heavy and not much action. It's not an action RPG like at all.
Yeah.
And so playing that at 2 a.m. and you're just going through dialogue, I just kind of set it down. I do want to get back to it though. And then after that, I played Star Wars Last Jedi. It came out last week. I played through that. I played on hard. There's a very hard mode too, but I didn't touch it. I loved it. Zach will probably talk more about it, but besides the performance issues it had with the frames and the texture popping and stuff like that, it was just such a wonderful experience. The game was awesome. The story was excellent. The bosses seemed pretty good. I don't know. As a Star Wars fan, I really liked it. And then what I'm playing now, I just booted up a game called Ravenlock. It's a game I had my eye on that was releasing on Xbox. It came out last week as well. It's sort of like a fantasy, it's a third-person game, but the camera sort of set. You can sort of tilt the camera left and right. And it's sort of based on Alice in Wonderland. It's pretty good. The combat is very simple, and the difficulty is, like, non-existent.
Uh-huh.
I think it's kind of skewed, though, because I just came off of playing Wolong, RE4 on hard, and Jedi Survivor on hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But really mixing it up to just a casual fantasy game. The art style's great, and it's smooth. You know, that's one thing Jedi Survivor wasn't. So, you know, being able to play that is fun. I'm just working through that. And then lastly, I purchased, it's a game called Inscription.
Mm-hmm.
It's a deck building game that I had heard really good reviews about when it released for PC, but it was PC only all this time. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, well, you know, maybe it'll release on console. And it did, but I had no idea. So I was browsing the store and I saw it. So I purchased that. So I plan on starting that tonight because I hear Ravenlock is very short, like a 3-4 hour game.
Okay.
So I know you like the Alice game. I would say give it a try.
Alice game.
Yeah.
It's like three, 4 hours. The combat's pretty simple. It's just a pretty fun game.
Okay. Yeah. It's funny because I really don't like Alice in Wonderland, the Disney movie, mm-hmm. but for some reason love the heck out of Alice Madness Returns.
Oh, okay. Well,
and then when you said, oh, this game's kind of Alice inspired, I'm like, oh, I wonder if it's like, you know, Alice in Wonderland inspired. I'm like, wonder if it's like Alice Madness Returns.
There's really no dark elements to it. It's just kind of this fantasy. You're just going through. It's a bunch of fetch quests.
Oh, interesting.
It's just, you know, something to pick up and play.
I must say I was very disappointed with how expensive the Pixel Remaster is. Like, if you want to get everything at once, is it 80?
It's 80.
Yeah.
$80. It's really expensive. So at least you can buy everything one at a time.
Yeah. So one at a time, everything's sort of priced differently too. Like the first one I think was $11.
Okay.
But I was looking through, I think 5 and 6 are like 20 15 or something like that.
Okay.
So I think overall, if you are gonna play all six, it's the $80 is definitely a better deal.
Yeah.
Than buying them individually.
I actually forgot until Dom mentioned it. I also played some of the RE4 remake. I was terrified, but it was really good. It was actually really funny because I had gotten to the village and, you know, did the whole thing, and then eventually the church bell rang. They vacated the village, and so I'm like, oh, okay, you know, I have a breather. I can run around, and so I was just pillaging everything, going around, just cleaning out every house, everything I could. But I forgot that one of the houses has a dude who's like, he's trapped in an armoire and he'll just like pop out, you know?
Yeah.
And so like, I thought it was fine, you know? And so like, I'm just going around and
looting.
And then all of a sudden he busts out and like, I like yelled and I was like, what was that? Yeah. Like, I forgot about him. Like, but still, like, why?
I don't remember him being in the original.
He's not in the original.
Oh, okay. Because I guess I know I saw Zach do it, and I saw him bust out of the armoire when Zach did it.
Yeah.
And so, but then I was, you know, I wasn't thinking about it. I was just like, oh, yeah, they're all gone.
Yeah, I was playing the 4 remake as well.
Yeah.
That game is scary. It's amazing how good it looks.
Yeah.
It's fun, though, because I've been playing it almost kind of side by side with the original. So, like, each week, like, we'll kind of get together to have dinner, and so that is when I'll play the original game. And that game still holds up so well, but it's just neat kind of seeing the side-by-side. But, like, I keep getting stuck because I'm just like, oh, this is creepy. And like the original even still freaks me out, but like at least I know what's coming.
Yeah, the original still freaks me out. I had actually downloaded it to my Switch just a couple of months ago, and I was playing around with it a little bit, and it still just terrifies me. But it was fun. Remake is fun.
And honestly, you getting past that section and getting to the bell, I think that's a good sort of idea of the difficulty of the game, like going forward.
Yeah.
In my opinion, I think that you getting past that part, you should be able to just go through the game. It's just the fear factor
it's
of
the
it
fear.
Now.
Yeah, it's not the difficulty for me. It's the fear.
That's good.
One more thing. Call of Duty, if you're playing Modern Warfare 2, I don't know if it's available anymore, but you can buy Shredder. Hmm. My friend told me, because she knows I like the Turtles, and she's like...
As an operator?
Yeah.
You can play as him?
As Shredder. It's the movie Shredder, like the one from the original movie, like the 90s.
Yeah.
So he's not in that disco fabric, but like they took that costume and turned it into a military-looking version of it, but with the helmet and the metal claws on his arms. And then you get these two little badass blades that you can run around with, which I think are exclusive
to him. Melee weapons?
Yes. That's awesome. Oh, it's so freaking cool. And then you get the foot soldier logo as a keychain you can put on your guns. And I'm just like, this is amazing. So I know who I'm going to be playing as for the rest of this game.
That's funny you said that, because I recently picked up Fortnite just for the hell of it, because they're doing a Star Wars event.
Yeah.
And you have to go through these quests throughout, you know, your playthroughs. And at the end of getting everything, you get Darth Maul. So I'm working towards getting Darth Maul, because he's pretty awesome.
So I just looked up the Shredder's costume in Call of Duty. He actually does look pretty cool.
Yep.
What say you, Zach? He's looking.
I certainly wouldn't spend real or even fake money on that.
It's a good segue into what Zach's been
playing. Yeah.
Oh, and one other thing, his voice acting's super funny. Like, if somebody, like, I forget what it is. I think it's like if you get somebody back, like somebody that killed you and then you get revenge on them. Or if they're about to kill you and you manage to, like, kill them, Shredder will go, "Fool." Oh, it's so funny because it's perfectly him. It's like, oh, what an a-hole. You call these people on the battlefield fools. Anyways.
Is it Warzone only, or can you do multiplayer?
No, it's a multiplayer.
Oh, that's so cool.
We still haven't played. We've got to play.
I know. And there's crossplay, so there's nothing holding us back.
That's right.
Very cool. For my part, I played the Resident Evil 4 remake. Really liked it enough to play it through twice, and then I was considering going through and getting a bunch of the unlockable stuff. Like, if you play, you beat it on with certain time thresholds or with like certain guns that you do or don't use, etc., you can get new accessories basically that give you different perks. And I liked the game enough that I was doing that for a bit, trying to optimize like an S rank professional run. I only got to like chapter 3 before losing interest, but I do really like it. I don't think there's any question in my mind that the original RE4 is better, but it is still a very good game. And especially like as like it has a lot of value for someone who's played the original a bunch, because it does mix stuff up. Some things it does worse, but some things it does do better. Like this new version of Luis, for example, I like the new Ashley a lot. So there's some story elements that I think are improved. And yeah, just like the little gotchas, like the dude in the armoire. Right. Mm-hmm. Or there's also like a house in the village where in the original, there's no window out of the bedroom except in mercenaries mode. So you can like go in there and like hole up there and keep enemies out just through a door. And in the new one, there's a window. So you got to keep looping around. There's no safe spot there.
Gotcha.
So stuff like that makes it fun. I think the Final Fantasy IV version on DS is similar in that it has some value for people who are used to all the ins and outs of the original. Mm-hmm. And that's a cool way to handle a remake, I think, kind of like a master mode or second quest. But I do think that, like, I miss the tone of the original compared to the remake. But I think I mentioned this like a month ago, that the original has a more arcadey feel. Like, in regard to things just like in the original Resident Evil 4, if you headshot a guy, he staggers, period, end of story. And in the remake, sometimes it takes 2 shots, sometimes it takes 3 shots. You just have to be ready to accommodate all sorts of different...
Now, when you say stagger, you just mean sort of like...
Like open him up for a melee attack or...
In the original, every headshot opened him up for a melee attack?
Well, there were some animation states where you would or wouldn't, but like if they were like an enemy doing a particular charge or whatever, if you hit him in the head, if it was capable of opening up for a melee attack, it would do it every time. Mm. It was completely predictable.
I see. Gotcha.
And in the remake, there's a lot more uncertainty there, which like fits the more horror-ish vibe they're going for, and also fits in with like the knife counter system that they have. But I prefer the original.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny, when RE5 came out, that was a point for a lot of people as far as the enemy, the prediction, the predictable nature of the enemies, like based on where you shoot them and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to RE4 and RE5, it was kind of the same thing you're alluding to. I remember reading that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, it makes sense as a lever to like, you know, make people uncertain and kind of fearful for what's going to happen, to make things unpredictable. But I've never been into the Resident Evil games for horror per se. Like, I like the style of action, like slower action gameplay. So I do prefer the original, but I do think it's really good. After that, I finally got around to, since, you know, as we're recording, in a week, Tears of the Kingdom is going to be out. And I really wanted to get through, I had started a long time ago, a playthrough of Breath of the Wild on Master Mode, which is the hard difficulty. And got like part of the way through. I think I had gotten 3 of the Divine Beasts, but hadn't done Urbosa, hadn't done a bunch of the shrines, hadn't done the DLC, and I wanted to get that done before Tears of the Kingdom out, or I thought I would just never go back to it. So I did. By far the hardest part of Breath of the Wild on Master Mode is the Trial of the Sword, which is like 3 sets of 12 to 15 floors where you start with 0 equipment, you just have to scrounge up a bunch of whatever, and if you die at any point, you got to start the entire set again. But the thing about Breath of the Wild's Master Mode, there are a few changes from normal. Enemies are tougher, which means they take more weapon durability to kill and they do more damage to you. But the big problem is that enemies regenerate in Master Mode. They regenerate 30% of their HP above the lowest you've gotten them down to. So if you get an enemy down to like 50% of their HP, they can regenerate back up to 80%. So you got to do big chunks of damage and stay on top of them.
When you say that they regenerate, how does that happen in real time? Like, as soon as you get them down to 50, you see the health? They don't have a health meter, so.
Fair question. What happens is, as long as you are regularly hitting an enemy, they don't regenerate at all. But if you go, like, 4 or 5 seconds without hitting an enemy, they do start to regenerate. And they can go up to 30% higher than they were.
Is there a visual sign that they're regenerating, or can you just tell, like, they should have been dead by now and they're not?
You get some glow on that, because you get health bars, like tiny health bars above every enemy. You get like a little bit of a glowing effect when the regenerating is happening.
Okay.
I think that works fairly well in a lot of cases in Master Mode. Like, if you're fighting a group of bokoblins with a moblin in the pack or whatever, it does what it's supposed to. It pressures the player to kind of try and separate one enemy from the pack and focus them down. You might want to use like fire or bombs or whatever to try and distract the other enemies while you're killing one of them. That works well. And against like the high challenge single enemies like a Lynel or a Hinox, that also works well, because what it means is you just have to be on your game. You can't like go run away and like eat a meal and then come back and finish them off. So that works. The problem is Breath of the Wild has some enemies that do a really good job of keep away. The Wizzrobes can be annoying depending on the terrain, but the big problem, and like single-handedly the reason that I would be hesitant to recommend Master Mode to anyone, is the Lizalfos, because they will opportunistically run away and then just try to pelt you from a distance. And it's especially bad if there's any water nearby, because they can move freely in the water. They can just go regenerate whenever they feel like it and then come back. So it's really hard to chase them down. And when that combined in the Trial of the Sword with not having as many resources, there's like one stage in particular in the first Trial of the Sword, which is an absolute nightmare. As soon as you load in, you have to headshot a Lizalfos like immediately, or he notifies 2 other Lizalfos to your presence and you just get swamped. It's on you're on like a tiny dock surrounded by water. So you have these 3 Lizalfos aggroed to you, and as soon as you do significant damage to one, like, they're probably going to jump in the water and go back, not to full health, but 30% up from wherever you were. So that was kind of a nightmare. That is definitely something I was like watching YouTube guides of, like, stage by stage, play by play, like, what am I doing wrong? How am I supposed to do this? It was fun to get through eventually, but...
I was telling my brother that you beat it in Master Mode, and his jaw was like, are you kidding me? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, well, if he didn't beat this, he said, it's better to do it before you beat the story because the buff you get is crazy. Is that true, or is that just him making something up? Like, did you get a permanent buff of any type after you beat Trials of the Sword?
Yeah, this is true for normal mode also. If you beat Trial of the Sword, you have to do... So, by default, once you have the Master Sword, its attack power is 30. You know, it can break, but your attack power is 30 when it's not broken. After you beat the first set of Trial of the Sword, it goes up to attack power 40, then 50, and then 60. Mm. There's another feature of the... It doesn't help that much with, like, the end of the game, though, because there's a feature of the Master Sword where when you are fighting Guardian enemies or when you are in Hyrule Castle, the attack power is 60 rather than 30.
So automatically?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So the benefit of doing Trials of the Sword is that you have the buffed power level of the Master Sword everywhere.
I see. Cool. Nice accomplishment.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I do think it's a really good game. I do think it's my favorite Zelda game, and I hope Tears of the Kingdom surpasses it. After that, I was juggling two things. I finally got around to playing Blasphemous, which I bought when it came out, like in 2019 or whatever. Mm-hmm. I was super excited for it. I bought it new, which was a mistake because it was a relatively new dev, and I experienced like a game-breaking bug after getting through half the game where it just like ate my progress. It's like if you got halfway through a Metroid game and then you suddenly didn't have super missiles, didn't have the morph ball, didn't like everything got taken away from you.
I remember this happening to you and you just basically just abandoning
it. It put me off playing the game entirely.
Yeah.
But I finally got around to beating it, and I do think it's very good. I would say like among the kind of like indie Dark Souls / Metroidvania influenced side-scrolling games, it's not as good as Hollow Knight. I'm gonna put Hollow Knight at the top, but Blasphemous I think is my second favorite behind that. Now that it's functional, it's more of like a kind of slow, deliberate action style, more like classic Castlevania. And I like that. That works for me.
Big emphasis on parrying too.
Yeah, big emphasis on parrying. You don't have like as much like air mobility as a lot of these games. Mm-hmm. You really just have to get good at like positioning and reading enemies. And
yeah, when we were talking about it, I started it up. I played maybe an hour of it, and I got into this pit like pretty early in the game, and there's four enemies, and one has like is like basically a bell, and he like runs into you like aimlessly.
Yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah.
If he hits the wall, he sort of like goes dong, and then you have like a chance to attack him. But I got really frustrated at that part. And I think it's just my patience level at that moment just wasn't there. So I got past it, died, and I started before that section again. And I was like, I just don't feel like doing this kind of game right now. So that's why I hung it up. This was right before I left to my trip. Mm-hmm. I was gone for like 4 days. I had downloaded it the day before we left, and I was just messing with it. And
yeah.
But it's really cool. The trailer Zach had sent me was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does... It takes a lot of inspiration from Spanish, as in Spain, Catholicism, like the Inquisition, and a lot of like weird pointy hats and, you know, leaning into like the crown of thorns or self-flagellating imagery kind of part of Catholicism.
Yeah.
Which pairs really well with being a really difficult game with some Dark Souls influences.
They don't hold back on like the executions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And the
no, they
blood
do not.
And gore.
Yeah. It's pretty gruesome for a pixel art game.
Zach was showing me some of it, and I was looking up some of it on my own while he was playing it, and I was pretty surprised by some of the... Like, there was that one scene you had shown me, Zach. It was a woman... you're going to have to remind me of her name. It was a woman who was like... She is perpetually... suffering. She had like prayed for the relief of suffering for, I think it was like prisoners who would be taken past her home or whatever, and basically it was like a be careful what you wish for sort of scenario. And so she started like taking on the pain and suffering of those people, but then that resulted in her having perpetually open wounds.
Yeah,
and, like, and so she's tied up for some reason, but she's like on her knees and her arms and her hands are like above her head, and she's just every breath she takes, it's like spurts of blood.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of surprised. I think also Robert just said it for a like a pixelated game. I was like, man, that's pretty gross.
Yeah, it's like a Promethean level of suffering, you know, like the Greek myth of Prometheus like having his liver eaten every day.
Yeah.
She's been, I thought, like, this is my imagination filling it in, but I thought like just because it was so gruesome, I assumed that she was tied up like by the tendons in her arm or something like that.
Mm. Yeah.
But yeah.
What was up with the people? Like, they were eating the either the sick and they're saying they're eating the infection out, or there was a part I passed and I just was like reading the dialogue of the people. They were either eating the people or trying to heal them in a way.
There were healers. I actually don't remember like what the mechanism was for the healing.
Doing, but there it was so twisted. I'm like, this is crazy.
Yeah, I was telling Angie while I was playing this, I can't remember a game that made me say, what the fuck, as much as Blasphemous. Yeah.
Just that trailer. I was like, what the fuck the whole time.
What was the thing you showed me? It was like a bull. It's like a baby born from a bull.
Oh my god!
The poor bull has been split in half.
Like as a collectible throughout the game, there are these little cherubs that are called Children of Midnight Children of Moonlight, and they're just floating around in cages. Eventually,
far cry from a caterpillar in Hollow Knight.
Huh?
Far cry from a caterpillar in Hollow Knight.
Far cry from a caterpillar. You get like deep in the game to, I don't know what the area is called, but there's like a bunch of paintings around. You go through some like doorway with no idea what's going on. And it's just like the whole room is one giant painting up against the wall of a bull in the moonlight. And you can interact with it. You can talk to the painting. And when you enter dialogue with the painting, you actually enter the painting where instead of being the bull has been split open right down the middle. Like somebody just sawed it straight in half. Mm-hmm. And there is a giant golden baby that has emerged. So you see like the inside of the bull's head just like completely split open like a butterfly in the background, and this giant angry baby in front just like, thanks for freeing some of the children of Moonlight. Please free the rest of them.
That is so twisted.
Yeah.
But the whole game is just peppered with things like this. So I finished the game, loved it, and then was reading about like the things they'd added since release. One of them was a big quality of life thing. It used to be that you could only fast travel between like the mirrors in the game, and there's only like six of them in the game. They added the ability to pay 20,000, whatever they call it, whatever the money is, in order to fast travel between any of the bonfires, basically, which is a lot more convenient.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they also added more content, including this new game plus thing where you can choose one of three. What do they call them? Penitences. And if you equip it, you can't unequip it. But so you can do all of New Game Plus with a combination of bonus and penalty. And if you get all the way through, then you get the just the bonus for further New Game Pluses. So like the one I picked gives me permanent mana regeneration, but my melee attacks do half damage. And if I finish it, then if I do New Game Plus again, I get the mana regeneration with regular attack damage.
Oh, that's pretty tight.
So you only get the good stuff as you carry it forward.
So you have to beat the game to have it a permanent buff or whatever.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
I'm most of the way through. I'm not all the way through. I'm hoping I can get all the way through my New Game Plus run of Blasphemous before Tears of the Kingdom comes out.
Are there at least multiple endings from what you know?
There are three endings.
Oh, well, that's good. That'll make your playthroughs a little...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
And then the other thing I've been playing was, like Dom, I played Jedi Survivor. I'd played Jedi Fallen Order. When it came out a few years ago, really liked it. Not like a masterpiece, but like a really solid, fun game. And I think Jedi Survivor, despite having some significant performance issues, even on console, is really good. I would say even better. I liked the story of Fallen Order. I think this is better.
Agreed.
I think there are some like twists that I definitely did not see coming in this game. The combat is certainly not my favorite of like the Souls influenced action games, but it's solid and it does its job of like clearly their priority is being like a cinematic Star Wars experience, like getting to feel like a Jedi. Specifically, I mentioned this to Dom earlier, just deflecting blaster shots with a lightsaber never gets old. Right. Super fun. Like the execution moves where you're like cutting droids in half or cutting people apart, like it looks super cool. The sound effects, the sound design, the look of the... And it's not just combat, like the look of the cantina that you spend a lot of the game in. This is true of Fallen Order also, but just like the small touch of like when you go to a new planet, it does this wipe effect that they do in the Star Wars movies also.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Like a transition, you mean?
Yeah,
yeah. I thought that was cool.
Oh, yeah. Well, the screen
wipe?
Yep.
Yeah. Just like stuff like that. The games are like Fallen Order, Survivor, clearly made by a team that really loves Star Wars and kind of like gets what is attractive and appealing about playing a Star Wars. To the extent of like the main character Cal Kestis in this game, like it's very easy to style him to look more like Luke or especially like Obi-Wan. like with the beard and like, yeah. You know,
my dude had the Anakin haircut from episode 3.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
little long hair when he's like turning into Darth Vader.
Zach asked me yesterday if I wanted to style Cal Kestis. Oh, nice. So I was like, yeah, give me the controller. Yeah.
No, so. Zach, you hit everything. I mean, the game is awesome. I couldn't recommend it enough. I would say probably if you're not like, I need to play this game now, buy it maybe in a few months. It might, one, have a discount, and two, they might have ironed out the performance stuff.
Might show up on Game Pass, too.
It might, yeah.
I started playing the first one on Game Pass recently because I saw it there. And, like, I have, like, a love-hate relationship with Star Wars, especially lately, more hate. But, you know, you get in the mood for Star Wars sometimes. And I started playing that game, and, like, to Zach's point, like, the little touches from, like, the original movie specifically are what make it so appealing. But, like, again, like, those transitions with the wipes, but just the feel of it. It's like, true Star Wars fans know what I'm talking about. Like, there's a feel that's there that you don't feel with a lot of the modern Star Wars stuff. And I think one of the bigger failings with, like, Disney Star Wars has been outside of the sequel trilogy, there's not a lot of Jedi stuff going on. You know, it's like from The Mandalorian to the one with Andor. I think it's just called Andor. Like, there's not a lot of, like, Jedi. So playing the game and being able to, like, you know, use a lightsaber and you're fighting stormtroopers, it's like, that is a big part of the draw. And, you know, it's like Uncharted Star Wars, like the game Uncharted.
Yeah.
I think it's really well done. And is it Cal or Cal?
Cal Kestis.
Cal's really likable. You know, like, I think his character model, like, his face is a little weird in the first one at times.
He gets a glow up in the second one.
Yeah, I definitely.
He's still a little goofy looking, but yeah.
But he's a good lead. He's actually likable. And I'm like, this, you know, like, hey, Disney, pay attention to what EA did. Like, this is cool. Like, give us more of this.
I read this somewhere and I can completely agree based on, like, the story of this one, how it ended and everything. Obviously there's gonna be a third one, and if they ended at that and it's a trilogy and they can knock that story out like they did this one, it probably is gonna be one of the better of the trilogies, even the movies, like, just story wise it was really good. It was a good level of, like, darkness in it. I don't know, I just really liked it.
Yeah,
and everything you said pretty much I agree with. Speaking of execution mode, sorry,
yeah.
Did you ever do the dual wield execution where you sort of, like, back up and you throw both blades in their chest and then call them back?
Yeah.
Dude, yeah. The first time I did that, I was like, damn, that was so cool.
Yeah, and just in terms of, like, Star Wars fan service, because that definitely is here in this game. I really like that you can do, like, even in the first one, you had, like, single lightsaber and then, or you could do, like, the Darth Maul lightsaber, mm-hmm. right? That's cool. In this one, they also add, like, neither of us wanted to use it, but, like, you can use a lightsaber with a blaster to kind of, like, mix up some, like, Han Solo iconography into your moveset. And you can also get, like, a Kylo Ren style, like, heavier duty lightsaber style. So I just, it's cool that you can mix all those up and like, kind of do that your own way. I do think that, kind of to Robert's point, I don't know, like, when Disney bought Star Wars, I think it was around then, I remember people saying things like, you know, Star Wars is, like, the world of Star Wars is so much bigger. There's so much more possibility. And, like, I get it. There's a lot going on in that world. But I don't think it's coincidental that we find Jedi Fallen Order and Jedi Survivor resonate when they it's going back to, like, more straightforward hero's journey stuff of, like, a guy, like, trying to, like, avoid being pulled into, like, a heroic role, finding a mentor and, like, going off and, like, doing all these things. Like, you can see a lot of elements to Cal Kestis' story that are, like, on a larger level callbacks to, like, A New Hope, right? And I think that is kind of, like, I don't know, like, deep down part of the primal appeal of Star Wars.
I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, like, Star Wars, a lot of the ancillary stuff is pulled into, like, the EU, the extended universe, like, back in the day. You know, if you wanted to read stories about the bounty hunters, they were there, or the Rogue Squadron stuff. Like, all those things are there, and they satisfy part of the fan base. But I think the broader appeal of Star Wars is that core tale with Luke and the Jedi and, you know, becoming a hero. But also the humanity of Luke. Because a lot of the criticism of, like, Rey is, like, that lack of fallibility. Mm-hmm. You know, like, Luke Fs up. You know, he has instances where he fails, and then he comes back stronger. Whereas Rey, you don't really get that feeling. It's just like she's there and she's great. And, like, Cal doesn't really feel perfect, at least so far in what I've played. And it's just kind of a shame that Disney has dropped the ball so much with the franchise.
Is this story considered canon?
I think
it's part of the new canon.
I think everything EU with Star Wars now is canon. Mm. So if it's in a book or a comic or a game, it's part of the larger story.
Oh, okay. Mm.
Speaking of fan service, can I talk about what you showed me?
Dom, you're done with.
Oh.
Is this a Survivor spoiler?
It's like a side quest spoiler.
It's fine.
Okay. Just want to make sure I don't ruin anything for Dom.
I beat the game. I didn't do everything, but I beat the game.
Okay. Well, Boba Fett's my favorite Star Wars character. And Zach was like, hey, I think there's going to be a Boba Fett cameo. Do you want to see it? I was like, yes. So I got to see it, and it was really cool.
Now, is it Fat Boba Fett or Cool Boba Fett?
It's Cool Boba Fett.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I'm assuming this is like after you do all the main bounties.
It's after the bounties, yeah.
I didn't do the bounties beyond the main mission bounty because, like I said, you know, the side stuff I just kind of left to go. But that's pretty cool.
I thought it was cool because Cal gets into a fight with another bounty hunter. And just as soon as, basically, it seems like he's going to make a decision. Like, is he going to let her go? Is he going to take her? All of a sudden, here comes Boba Fett.
Oh, damn.
He just like drops in, you know, it's like a dark angel.
That's pretty tight.
And he takes
her
ass.
See, I want to go back and beat the side stuff for stuff like that.
It's super cool. He like takes her ass out and he's just like super chill about it. But then he also is like, you're a Jedi. I know what you're capable of. I don't like you. Get away from me. We're not friends. It was actually really cool.
I think the developer is like, their intention was for the player to beat the story first. But it almost seems like you're dropped into Kobo, which was like one of the main hubs of one of the main areas of the world that's mainly open world. And yes, you have a main mission objective, but there's just, it's huge, right? And there's a percentage of how much of the areas you've explored. And so I just go on a side missions. I go through these caves or whatever, through the waterfalls, whatever it is. And then I get to a spot where, oh, you don't have this traversal item yet. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Then I get that traversal item. I know I saw a green wall that I can traverse through now. So I'll do that, get past it, and then I'll hit another wall where I don't have the traversal item again. That's where I fell off of doing like the side content first. I think I realized in that moment, like, I think I need to get through the story first because this is just frustrating me. I'm spending all this time getting here. I can't go past it. I got to backtrack.
Kobo is like a little too big to the point that when by the time you get to like the Shattered Moon, it's refreshing how concise the Shattered Moon is in comparison.
I can't recommend it enough. I thought it was great. So
yeah, definitely if you're considering playing it, you should play Fallen Order first because the story I think does a really good job of picking up on some threads from the original.
And the recap is not great.
But also the first game is good, right? So don't skip it.
You get to pick your own lightsaber color. Like, you constantly get to just fine-tune it. What more do you need?
Yeah.
What lightsaber color did you go for, Dom?
Oh, I mixed between whatever Isaac wanted, my son.
Very nice.
Yeah, we would just mess with it when I got new equipment.
So you can just constantly change it? You're not...
At a workbench. There's, like, workbenches scattered throughout the whole world.
Okay.
Yeah. Green is, of course, the correct answer for lightsaber color.
Yeah, I did... I went through blue and white. He wanted white for some reason.
Oh, right. White one. That's neat. Yeah. That's neat.
I did most of the game with an orange lightsaber.
Orange is cool. Mm-hmm. Especially with like a gold. What's it called?
Yeah.
You can do a lot with like the different parts of the hilt. There's like the hilt of your lightsaber has something like 6 different component pieces.
Yeah.
And each one of those can be customized separately. So you can do a lot with the look of just the lightsaber.
Yeah.
It's funny, like in Fallen Order, there's like a lot you can do to like customize the look of your lightsaber, but it felt like all you could do to customize your character was like, what kind of poncho do I want to wear?
Yeah, that bored me.
Yeah. I remember that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's still not the best for clothes, in my opinion.
Yeah.
The clothes, like I wish there was something really dope you could just wear like default to, but everything... To me, nothing really stood out to me. Yeah. I like the Jedi outfit.
I was styling him yesterday, I thought like his kind of standard bomber was pretty cool. And then I came up with like a good color combo that I think looked good. It was like a lot of greens and browns, and then I gave him the scrapper shirt.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a white or an ivory. He looked cool.
Yeah.
But I also agreed, nothing else caught my eye. Like, the poncho was ugly as hell. And then, like, some of the other clothes were just a little weird.
Yeah, I found myself updating his apparel and his haircut and goatee probably every time I did like a big mission, I'd change outfits, you know, to whatever I was like getting from Doma's shop or, you know, whatever else. That was awesome.
Yeah. They should let you put whatever skin you want on him. Like, you know, fine, you can't change the cutscenes or whatever, but like, just make him Luke if you want. Like, why not? Like, there's games that are like that or... Like, the gameplay, it's like the gameplay doesn't change and you can change the skin. Like, think of the Lego games, right? Where it's just like you have 100 different Lego figures. And it's just like, I feel like having Obi-Wan here. I'm going to put Obi-Wan. Like, let him be Obi-Wan. Let him be Luke. Let him be Mace Windu. Like, who cares,
That should absolutely just be a new game plus thing.
Yeah.
Like, that would
be... Yeah, that'd be kind of cool.
I want to play as Padme.
run around as Padme. I mean, it would be really cool if you could do that. Because, like, one of my favorite things in Metal Gear Solid 4 is how if you beat the game once and then you play through it again... You can unlock the young snake face camouflage, or what's it called? Forgetting the name of it now. It's not camouflage. It's a solid. It's a Metal Gear name. Whatever. Anyway, you can become young.
Is
snake.
It like Octo Camo?
Yes, the Octo Camo. You can get the face camo, and you just be young snake. And it's like because like you play that game, and like it's fun, but like old Snake and his mustache, just like he doesn't look as cool. Mm-hmm. But then they give you that camouflage, and you're just like, and now I can play the whole game as this. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm playing the whole game as young Snake. Like,
side note, I was mentioning I was playing Fortnite for the Star Wars event. In the store that you could just purchase outright is the Anakin from Episode 3 skin, where he's in like the all black when he fights Obi-Wan.
Right.
And then you can buy it with the Padme skin from Episode 2. And the only reason I did was because it's two options. It's the all-white suit that she wears when she's, like, tied up.
Yeah.
It's that. Uh-huh. The alternate, if when you buy it once, you buy both.
Yeah.
The alternate is the same outfit, but it ripped. Like, all the way up to like the under boob.
The under boob.
And so yeah,
I'm surprised that they even have that as an option. Yeah. You know, like, oh, this is too sexy. This
like they'll
is
have
too
it ripped.
It'll
be like a black bodysuit underneath. Yeah.
Like it's already a known armor. Thing that the female character models in Fortnite like they have a big ass. Uh-huh. So like, all the female skins like they all have the same sort of frame. So yeah. It's like her with a half shirt. I'm like, hey. I'll buy this. I'll go get Darth Maul using Padme.
Well, it's like I started up Woe Long, and you can do the character creator. Oh, and like it's the guy, and it's like, oh, it can be the girl. And I'm looking at the stock girl character. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, Team Ninja.
Well, that's my character for the rest of the game. I mean, why not?
Oh, that's funny, because the character I made, I was like, wow, he's pretty handsome.
That jawline, though.
They talk a lot about how, like, nowadays with all the issues people have about things, that, like, female characters will suffer from, like, strange things happening with their chest area.
They look like pecs.
Well, like, pecs. Like, people refer to it as, like, the omni-boob. So yeah. It's like, you can't define the two, so it becomes this one thing.
Mono-lump.
Yeah, the mono-lump.
All right. This has been enough, like...
Sorry for the tangent.
Yeah. Even as a woman, I find it troubling.
But I think that's it in terms of what I've been playing. Obviously, as soon as Tears of the Kingdom comes out, that's...
So basically, Blasphemous New Game Plus until Tears?
Yeah.
Nothing's on your radar to try and knock out?
No, it's the Blasphemous New Game Plus. Yeah.
For sure. Plus, it's only a week, so...
Yeah.
I know. I did pick up... Like, if I'm playing on the go, I'm playing Breath of the Wild. I'm trying to beat it, but there's no way I'm going to beat it before Tears, but... Yeah.
Before we move on to our topic of the day, our Metacritic Fantasy Draft update. It has been a tumultuous month. I'd say looking over the scores, April in general was a pretty bad month for game scores, with the exception of the recently discussed Jedi Survivor.
Anyone picked that up from the thing?
Dom had it.
Okay.
All right. But just like going through the list of what has come out since we last recorded on April 18th, Minecraft Legends came out. That was one of Robert's. And it got a paltry 71. And then on...
It's by far his lowest scoring game, right?
Well, if we don't count Suicide Squad, which is a default zero because it's not coming out this year. But yeah, otherwise it's his lowest score. Also this month on April 24th, Mega Man Battle Network Collection. 78. I don't know if that's quite where Robert wanted it. With his second pick.
What was the one that got 71 just now, you said?
Minecraft Legends.
Oh, yeah, that was a disappointment.
He was so...
Mega Man should have been in the 90s.
He was so insistent, too, that, yeah, that I thought Minecraft, that was gonna do well. She was like, oh, yeah.
Because Dungeons is really good. Because yeah. They dropped the ball.
They did score well, too.
And then April 27th, we had The Last Case of Benedict Fox, which for a week just didn't have a score at all. Like, no one reviewed it. But I checked today, and it did finally get some scores, and it has an unfortunately low score of 69.
Yeah, I had some hype for this game to play personally.
Yeah.
I remember when they revealed it, I think it was just like an Xbox showcase. You know how they do where they go through a bunch of games that are coming out?
Yeah.
It definitely caught my eye. It looked really good. And then I didn't even realize it released because I wasn't paying so much attention to it.
Yeah.
So I think that goes to show, one, Xbox wasn't advertising it, and maybe for good reason based on these scores.
Yeah.
And two, I mean, even with this score, I think there was only about under 10 reviews.
Yeah, yeah.
Total. Very on Metacritic.
Little. Yeah.
Under 10 reviews when I checked. So, I mean, I don't know what the deal is. I don't know if it's like an Xbox thing or what.
Not to deviate, but it makes me think of a recent comment from, what's his name? Spencer? Is it Phil Spector?
Spencer.
Talking about how he was basically saying, like, software doesn't matter, like, in terms of building your user base, I think.
No, he's saying that Xbox can't The Last of Us their way out of the problem that they're in.
Mm. Yeah, and, like, I don't know how much I agreed with him on that, because, like, first of all, you guys just tried to buy Activision, meaning you want software. If you didn't want software, you wouldn't be trying to buy that entire company with its huge catalog. But, like in this instance, you're talking about how that game's coming out, and it doesn't even really get any hype. And it's like, Microsoft has a software problem. Like, you guys need to make more games, good games, and promote them. It's like, is one Last of Us going to save you? No. But a Last of Us and a Gears and a Halo and a, you know, all the IPs that you could be pumping out stuff for would make a huge difference. Like, I cannot remember the last big Xbox game that got me pumped that was like, oh, I've got to play that. You know, it's embarrassing.
I think part of his interview, because I did read into it a little bit, this whole thing with Activision and them trying to build a case that Xbox is in last place and, like, you know, this deal is not going to harm PlayStation to the point of their destruction and shit like that. I think he's almost puffing smoke in the air, like, these kind of interviews, like, making them look like, oh, look at poor Xbox a little bit, where he's saying, you know, we're not going to be able to compete, you know, maybe putting that angle out there too. You know, sort of watching what he says in that regard. But I agree. I mean, some of the stuff he said, I didn't agree with. I think the most important thing for any gamer is games. What I will say is, you know, the media will sort of change a lot of what is actually being said. And for the most part, the media is more Sony PlayStation fans, you know, trashing Xbox, I think, more.
Yeah.
And so that's just kind of what we're dealt, like, on Twitter feeds and whatever else. It just kind of spirals into that direction. But, you know, Xbox, what I've noticed is that they do take some risks as far as games. Like, we look at this game, The Last Case of Benedict Fox, and...
Hi-Fi Rush.
Yeah, Hi-Fi Rush. You know...
Penitent.
Yeah, I know some PlayStation fans, podcasters, and in real life that are like... You know, as much as we knock on Xbox or whatever, it's like, we sort of miss that variety, you know, like the PS3 era where these wonky games come out, and maybe it's a hit for, someone's going to love it, someone's going to hate it.
Or like the DS era with a lot of quirky, interesting games.
Yeah, yeah, you know, but like Sony used to have like Gravity Rush and Little Big Planet and like all these other like weirder.
And while third-person, first-party exclusives, for the most part, it's not the same as a Ghost Horizon, what's the other, Last of Us. You know, they do want that variety, I think, deep down.
Everybody loves rivalry. Like, the rivalry is what makes it fun. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you've just got, like, one thing, and then, like, you know, there's stuff to play. But, I mean, Xbox, like, it's just frustrating. Like, if you look at Halo... Now, granted, you can make this format work. Fortnite makes it work, where there hasn't been a Fortnite 2. It's just, hey, here's Fortnite and then new seasons, and you just keep building. But they do a good job of differentiating the seasons and making them interesting. Halo Infinite came out, and, like, didn't they say something like, this is the next 10 years of Halo? Like
multiplayer-wise, at least.
Yeah, and it's just like, no. It's like, you know, at least in terms of Halo, at least in terms of how they've done it so far, what will build more hype for Halo is it's like the individual entries. You know, it's like here comes a new game and there'll be a new set of multiplayer and then you go and play it. Instead, you have this one game that came out, what, 2-3 years ago now? And like I never think of it ever. And they do a terrible job of making you want to think about it. If you look at Gears, I mean, first of all, it's called Gears. It's like, well, the war's over. That's why we renamed it. It's like, dude, your most prominent franchise along with Halo is Gears of War. It's like, and then you butcher the name for whatever reason, and then you give it this cast of characters. It's like, no one cares about these characters. It's like, when you think of Gears, you think of Marcus, and you think of all the other cool dudes that are part of that team. And instead, they shied away from it. And it's just like, all these things they've done to make themselves irrelevant. And it's just so irritating. Like, if I was a more diehard Xbox fan, I'd be very upset with the state of things.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with what you're saying. One sort of counter argument is that, like I was saying, the media sort of construes this, like, vision of Xbox. And at the end of the day, 70, 75, 80s on Metacritic are not bad. You know what I mean? That doesn't mean they're bad games. So, I mean, you know, I'll take, you know, 75s and 80s, and I'll play them for myself. But, yeah, I mean, they need a big push in the first party, you know, side of things. And, you know, we'll get into our topic of the day with performance and stuff. But, I mean, like, Redfall released, and it's unanimously trash, you know what I mean? Yeah. And that's just, that's defeating for an Xbox fan like myself.
Yeah, there's clearly some kind of mismanagement on Xbox's part. Yeah. Like, Redfall was already supposed to come out last year, right?
Yeah.
There's no reason for Redfall to be, and not even just technically, right? Because I've seen people say, like, even if you brush all the technical things to the side, like, the core game loop, the design isn't there.
I've watched enough gameplay to know that I'm not touching it for a while. Yeah. So they do some real patches. Yeah. Sorry, we went on a major tangent.
We'll get there soon. So like I said, Last Case of Benedict Fox, just a 69. That was on April 27th. April 28th, we had two releases. One was Star Wars Jedi Survivor, also on Dom's list, and a very healthy 86. But we also had Dead Island 2 on Angie's list. And that was 76, like not terrible, but probably not what you were hoping for.
I definitely thought it would be higher, yeah.
And, Peace Day Resistance, on May 2nd, we had Redfall's release. And its score has been dropping as the week has gone on, but it's down to 58 at this point. So not counting Suicide Squad, which isn't coming out this year and is therefore automatically a zero, this is far and away the lowest score on anyone's list. It's on mine. It dropped me from being temporarily in first place after the release of Mega Man Battle Network to last place. So my score is now down at 75.6. Dom is in third place at an average score of 76.2. Angie's in second at 78. So we are all trailing well behind Robert at 83.7.
Nice job, Rob.
I still think Zelda's going to make all the difference.
It's going to make a difference, but like the thing is, like, you know, a game like Dead Space, Resident Evil 4, even Theater Rhythm, they're all like high 80s, low 90s. There's only so much better a game can do than that. Your average is 83.67. Even if Zelda scores 100, right, that's only 17 points better than your average, whereas Redfall is 25 points worse than your average. So there's just, like, not a lot of room for a single game to really lift the score up that much.
Yeah, for Hogwarts and Theater Rhythm to get 87s, I mean, that is just, that's holding it down for you, Rob, for sure.
It's definitely still possible that Robert's not going to win. I think it is possible for any of us to win, depending on how the rest of the year breaks, but I would certainly say Robert is the favorite at this point.
Yeah. Hopefully Diablo 4 gets a 97.
Yeah. But, like, yeah, April as a whole, surprisingly weak month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jedi Survivor is the only one that got good reviews.
Yeah.
It was kind of light, too, on releases, huh, compared to the first 3 months of the year.
April, well, not for our list. We had a number of things represented for our lists.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true.
May, there's not much. I think the rest of May is just System Shock coming out of the end of May.
Who has
and Tears of the Kingdom. Right, Tears of the Kingdom also. Cool. Best of luck to everyone but Robert.
Whatever.
Whatever. So moving on to the topic of the day, inspired in part by Blasphemous, in part by Jedi Survivor, in part by Redfall, is performance and specifically like glitches and things going wrong in video games.
At launch specifically, right?
Or well, especially at launch. Especially and at things launch. Get better as times go. Even like back in the Super Nintendo era, I remember Final Fantasy VI or Final Fantasy III on the Super Nintendo. There was a, I know this because I spent so much time downloading and playing ROMs on the internet, but there's like a 1.0 and a 1.1 version of that ROM where they did some bug fixes for the latter release. So like even in the cartridge era, there were patches. It's just you didn't get the patch unless you bought the patched game cartridge. But yeah.
They never announced this back in the day either, right? Like they didn't tell you there were patch versions of anything coming out. They just would slip them in, right?
Yeah. And just if you bought it after a certain point, you'd probably get the patched version. But yeah, I mean, certainly as time has gone by and as game developers and publishers have gained the ability to push patches out over the internet, that's been a double-edged sword. Like, it's good that we can get stuff fixed now, but
we use it as a crutch too much, I think.
Definitely do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, Miyamoto's philosophy, you know, oft quoted, you know, about how a bad game is forever. I feel like I don't think developers necessarily disregard that. It just feels like almost like something from another time. Like, you know, Miyamoto's philosophy of a bad game is forever. I feel like it's not just about how bad it is for the consumer, it's also a bad mark on the developer.
Yeah.
And it used to be like a mark of shame. You're putting out either crap or you're putting out some imperfect game that you should feel bad about because you're asking people to buy it. And now that's just been replaced with a culture of, well, if there's problems, we can just patch it day of, or we can patch it really quickly after release. And I just personally don't feel like that's a mentality that developers should have.
Yeah, what's interesting is it's not, like, Miyamoto's not correct anymore. It is not the case that if a game launches buggy that it has to stay buggy.
Right.
But he's, like, reputationally correct. No matter how much they fix up Redfall, Redfall's Metacritic score is always going to be crap. And people's opinion of Arkane as a developer are always going to be lower than they were from before Redfall came out. Even if the game gets better, the reputation is going to stick with Redfall and Arkane forever.
Although I don't think he's necessarily talking about bugs, right? I think he's talking more just about overall quality. You know, yeah. Like if the concept is screwed, that is going to fail forever. Because like if you look at Cyberpunk, its issue was bugs. The game itself is good. And then after how many, you know, patches now, it, like a lot of people talk about, go get Cyberpunk now, because now all those bugs have been ironed out and it's playable. So I don't necessarily think he's wrong in that regard. If your game concept isn't good, it's not going to change over time. Mm-hmm. But you can now fix bugs that were there at the beginning and get them out.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, you look at a game like Cyberpunk, and story-wise, concept-wise, great, right? Wonderful. But the bugs, I mean, they were giving refunds for PlayStation and Xbox and PC with no questions asked. They even took the game from the storefront digitally from PlayStation. I mean, this was just a technical, shit show. Now, I mean, the game's in a good state. And, people rave about it, that it's one of the better games. Now, I'll use another example, like No Man's Sky. I know that was like a promise that wasn't delivered at launch. It wasn't so much the technical part of it, from my memory. I mean, I could be a little bit off the mark, but just the lack of content there. I never played it, but this is just what I've read and heard. And then patches and updates down the line, now it's like, oh, if you gave No Man's Sky, it's No Man's Sky, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A shot at launch and just were unimpressed, it just didn't you know, hit you the way it wanted, you wanted it to, try it now because it's a completely different game. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think No Man's Sky is like a Destiny where it's a live service game, right? Mm-mm. So, you know, there's two types of shaky launches like that, I think. Mm-hmm. Technical side, like Cyberpunk, like Jedi Survivor, mm-hmm. And then just the what are we doing? We need to add content later to make up ground, like No Man's Sky. And, you know, Fallout 76, too, that's almost a combination of both, you know, technical, yep. live service, and it just didn't deliver anything to Fallout fans and new fans alike. You yeah. know? So
I was actually going to bring up Fallout 76, but in both the case of CDPR and Bethesda, it's not like they had never made mistakes before, but these were two companies that I think had overall pretty good reputations, especially CDPR, and then Cyberpunk and Fallout 76, you know, really didn't tarnish necessarily their reputation, because I think they're both pretty respected, I think CDPR especially. But this is kind of what I was getting at when I was talking about, you know, Miyamoto, is like the bad game is forever is maybe not literally true anymore, because you can patch it, get rid of the things that are bad, or at least try to. It's the memory of it. And it's kind of like Final Fantasy 14, you know, the very original game that released. Mm-hmm. We're well beyond that. We're well past that point. It's been many years. That really bad launch is, it's a memory, but it's still a memory that people have, and still something that I think tarnishes that game's memory, because when people talk about it, that's something that they're always going to talk about.
I don't think it tarnishes that game's memory, but I do think that it does present a challenge. Like, that's part of the story of, like, Final Fantasy XIV, rising from the ashes, becoming better than it was, mm-hmm. fixing those things. And that's kind of held up as, like, a reason that people trust the development team now, is that they were willing to put in the work to do that. Mm-hmm. But you do have to put in the work to not only rebuild the game, but also remarket. Like, you need to make the case all over again of why things are going to be different. And that's expensive. And most companies that put out games that have problems, whether just technical issues or bigger game design issues, they're not going to have, or the publisher isn't going to have the appetite and the budget to fix it.
I mean, like, I know that, you know, games now it's an entirely different world in terms of development. The technology, the budgets. I just don't understand why it is the norm now. Why it is the case that a buggy game, a game with a lot of different issues, gets released in that state.
Shareholders.
Yeah,
I mean, because it's financial predictions, right? It's like, oh, well, if you get it out in quarter two, it'll bump this. And then they're like, well, you gotta get it out by quarter two, so who cares if it's buggy?
I get that, believe me. Working for tech companies, you're always beholden to the board and all that. But I guess what I just don't understand is, I mean, I know the development is much more sophisticated, but even despite those deadlines they have to meet, I guess I just don't understand why the culture now is just so many games come out with these issues. And maybe,
because you couldn't before, you know, I mean, if you think of like the errors of like Cyberpunk. Cyberpunk would be dead, because unless you plan to, you know, keep printing batches of the disc, like if it came out in the buggy state it was in, mm-hmm. you know, during the 360 era, mm-hmm. done. But now, because you can patch everything, I mean, you're not beholden to a real high level of quality. It's a matter of gaming it, even though we're talking about games, right? Mm-hmm. You're gaming how much error you can throw out there and get away with it. Because you'll always hear little things like, oh, you know, Pokemon has a glitch where if you have three Pokeballs and you save in this region, the game will freeze or your save file will be corrupted. And those are annoying, but they're also somewhat avoidable, especially if word gets out, make sure you save and you don't have just three Pokeballs or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But, and then you do a patch. And it annoys people and you might complain, but it's not going to stop you from buying it. When the glitches get to the level that they were with Cyberpunk, like, people are straight up telling each other, don't even buy it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so bad, you can't play it. or it's going to be a really crappy experience, you know, wait till it's $20 at GameStop and they patched it 10 times. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's where that comes from.
Yeah.
Because I think that if you could get away with this during the SNES era, then they would, right? Like, they would have been doing these patches and wouldn't have cared. And
yeah. I don't know. I think, like, the technology is both a gift and a curse. You know, we get these incredible looking games, all the different types of content, all the different things you can do in it. But at the same time, that technology has allowed developers to put out substandard product. And I don't really know how to feel about that. And it's interesting because I constantly find myself going back to older games just over and over again, sometimes especially older games. And I don't know. I just feel like the technologically advanced era that gaming has found itself in is great, but it's, I think, also bringing a lot of baggage and issues with it.
I think Robert's right that this is just what they can get away with now. I think, like, you know, Angie, we both had the experience of working, not like working in either marketing or like other roles where it's a normal thing, you know, in the corporate world, like sales, especially in like B2B, sales will make promises about what the product can do that are not accurate. And then it's the responsibility of like the product team or somebody else to fulfill that, to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
You're just like hoping, like the sales team is hoping that the product team can lay down track fast enough to keep up with the steam that's coming out of sales, right? And like, I just think you have a lot of that fake it till you make it stuff. And that's part of just how video games get made too.
Yeah.
Where like people are like, oh yeah, it's totally going to look like this. You know, there used to be like a problem. I think it's less so these days, but what do they call it? Bull shots from like, you know, people were like previewing or demoing video games and were just fabricating screenshots that were not representative of the game and then fabricating video that made it look like it was in engine, but it was actually pre-rendered. Mm-hmm. And like,
that's so dirty when they do that.
Yeah. Or like when games would come out and you'd see a lot of like cutscenes, but you wouldn't see a lot of gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
Or they weren't even really cutscenes at all. They were just kind of like mock video that they created to advertise the game. And it would be like not actual gameplay footage, you know, in little letters on the bottom of the screen.
But I do think that the deeper problem is more longstanding and shared by more than just video games. Of like over-promising while something is being worked on and just hoping that it's going to like work out and you're going to be able to deliver what you're promising. And then they diverge more and more and there's not really a good way to handle that.
Yeah.
So you release a buggy game because that's what you got by the time the shareholders insist you got to push it out.
You like the term going gold, right?
Mm-hmm.
You hear that a lot. Oh,
yeah.
So such and such went gold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't mean anything, really. It means copies are ready to be sent out, but the team is working to iron out the wrinkles on the back end. And then right when you plug that disc in, whenever you get it or buy it digitally, that's the day one patch. It's what they've been working on since, you know, it went gold to now. And that is sometimes, you know, day one patches to me are one thing.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a day one patch and the game is still like either unplayable or really bad, technically speaking, that's what rubs me the wrong way. You know, we're talking about like sort of the developer side, you know, oh, you know, they're getting away with what they can and stuff like that. I think as on the consumer side, we sort of are almost forced to adjust in a way that like back then we'd be in line to pre-order, you know, we wanted day one. You know, now, you know, it's if you can wait, you know, playing a game at launch is rolling the dice a little bit now, for the most part.
Yeah.
Right. Nintendo and PlayStation, those first party games that are exclusive, you know, the developer put all their time in developing it for that system. So Tears of the Kingdom, it's all been development for Switch. There's no optimization on this PC versus Xbox Series S and X. So, you know, and same with like God of War and PlayStation. They had all the time and resources to make this game on one system.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, those are a little less shaky, a little less of a risk, in my opinion, in my experience. Like throwing in God of War, I think obviously there was a patch. But, it played and ran smooth, didn't crash, you know. And yeah. then, you know, you take a game like Jedi Survivor, which we just started, mm-hmm. that just released last week. And they've done a patch already. Like, they yeah. announced, oh, we're going to do a console patch on this
That's
day.
That's not even counting the day one patch. Right. Which there was.
Yeah, so day one patch one when it released. Mm-hmm. And then they did a second patch, like, a day later. And for me personally, it ran worse. There's parts that ran worse mm-hmm. after the patch. So I can only recommend the game so much because I'm like, well, if you want sort of like a janky experience as far as frame rates dip and texture pop-ins and stuff like that, then go for it.
Yeah.
But if you could wait and avoid pre-ordering at this point for certain, you know, games and things like that.
Yeah.
The other side I was going to say for the consumer is we're sort of forced to set our expectations. Like for Tears of the Kingdom, my expectation is, okay, it's a Switch game.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's going to be better. It's going to be technically better than Breath of the Wild, right?
Mm-hmm.
But with that, what's going to come with it? Is it going to be able to hold 30 the whole time?
No way.
You know what I mean?
It's going to aspire to 30 and drop down to 20.
Yeah, so, but our expectation is there. Yeah. So guess what? We're not going to be disappointed when it's running at 20 frames.
Yeah.
Now, I look at that and I was super hyped for Redfall. I really love the whole concept of vampire slaying and, you know, this co-op story base, like all the stuff they were leading up to it was hyping me up. You know, you could play the story with my friend
mm-hmm.
and then the story carries over just for your profile. So I could keep going in the story, but when he jumps in, you could do the story with him. Everything saves as its own save file.
Yeah.
And all these little things were, you know, appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then they release announcement about a month before it launches. Oh, 30 frames only at launch. Working on a patch for 60. In a first-person shooter, that's just laughable to me.
Yeah.
It's like, if I'm developing this kind of game, mm-hmm. that should be at the top of my list.
From the beginning.
Beyond anything.
Yeah, from like number one priority from the beginning.
Yeah, and that just is a big blow for me personally because I'm like, yeah, I'm not touching this.
Mm-hmm.
I can't play a first-person shooter this fast-paced shooter at 30 frames.
Yeah.
And then now it released, not only is the frames a problem, there's so many issues with this game, like AI problems, story problems, like what the hell were they doing mm-hmm. type of problems.
It's weird, like Deathloop got like nines, but it was also like people were commenting that the AI in Deathloop was like super stupid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's just one thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if I deal with a bad AI, it just makes the game easier. Like, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But if the stuff that I've seen on Redfall, it's like, imagine if I pre-ordered that game.
Mm-hmm.
$80. And, well, like, back in the day, right? I went to GameStop and I pre-ordered this. I'm ready for it. And that released,
mm-hmm.
it forces our hand, mm-hmm. you know? And I don't think it's good for the developer. It's not good for the consumer.
No.
It's just going down a hole that I think is just becoming the standard, and I just don't think it should be.
It shouldn't be.
Yeah.
The thing, too, about the video game industry that's different from the other consumer products is if you have a company that's continuously putting out shit, you can be like, I'm not buying your stuff anymore. You know, I'm going to buy whoever your competitor is. I'm just going to throw something random out there. Like if detergent, you know, I keep buying Gain and there's different issues with Gain. I'm just like, I'm not buying Gain anymore. I'm going to go to Tide.
Or I'll buy Maytag instead of the Kenmore or whatever.
But in video games, there's only so many, you know, there's only so many platforms. We're and there's
watch
only
a movie.
Yeah. Yeah, we're only like so many like devs or whatever. Because and then, you know, because like
they're not fungible. Like if you like Zelda, you like Zelda. Angie wouldn't be satisfied playing Darksiders instead of Zelda.
Exactly. And what I was going to say to that was, you know, CDPR and Cyberpunk easily could have had people that were like, you know, I'm done with CDPR. You know, like this is an insult to me. But then if you're also a Witcher fan, though, you know, like nobody else has the Witcher IP, it's CDPR's. Mm-hmm. And so if you're like, well, I'm done with them until the next Witcher game comes out, you know, it's like you're kind of stuck. You can take a stand for only so long.
It's like, well, I won't like their tweets.
Yeah, exactly. So that's part of what has, I think, gamers in a weird position is you can take a stand for only so long, but this is part of the reason why this is the norm is because there's really no way to hold devs accountable other than just never buying anything they ever put out again.
Yeah. And kind of what I was saying with like setting expectations, there's no doubt in my mind that Jedi Survivor is a quote-unquote next-gen, now current-gen, right? Because we're in the PS5 series era, but a next-gen title. There's no doubt in my mind, because the attention to detail, the graphic fidelity, for the most part, like the scenery, there's some weird choices they made as far as in-game, like real content. Cal looks super blurry. Like, he has the Forspoken effect that they were talking about for that game. Mm-hmm. Where it just looks kind of a mess, but graphically the game is just incredible, and when it works, it's, you know, one of the best traversal type of games, the traversal and action segments of the game are like perfect. Mm-hmm. When Plague Tale Requiem was announced and they said 30 FPS, now I'm like, 30 FPS for Redfall is unacceptable, right? Mm-hmm. But my expectation for Plague Tales, it's like a walking simulator. You know what I mean? It's a lot different. It's not super fast-paced. You know, you have thousands of rats on the screen at any given moment. Mm-hmm. And I played it, and it looked incredible. It ran pretty smooth, and it didn't feel like the 30 FPS was a burden to me at all in that kind of game. But, you know, for like Redfall in specific, I mean, you know, it's just not going to work for me.
Yeah, with all of these, and it's always been the case that bugs aren't necessarily a deal breaker. It just depends on whether it interferes with your ability to enjoy the game. Mm-hmm. And that goes to go back to the like what we've been playing section. Dom mentioned he was playing the original Final Fantasy, and of course he's playing the Pixel Remaster. Mm-hmm. But we were texting like back and forth while he was playing. And, like, I think I mentioned some of the things that were bugs in the original version of Final Fantasy. Like, your Black Mage had an intelligence stat, had no effect on the gameplay whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Weapons were supposed to have different critical hit rates. The programmer messed up. They had no effect. Like, different critical hit rates for different weapons didn't matter. The index of the weapon instead affected the critical hit rate, which just meant later weapons had higher crit rates than earlier ones. Mm. Stuff like that, like, the more you know about the original Final Fantasy, the more you realize like there's just a ton of mess in the code, and it does affect the gameplay, but it affects it in ways that don't compromise like the core experience of the game. Mm-hmm. Your Black Mage is still casting fireballs and they're still doing damage. Your ninja's swinging their katana and still getting critical hits. So like bugs are a problem to the extent that they prevent you from enjoying the game. What happened to me with Blasphemous is like a really clear example, because it actually like completely deflated me when I got to, it was like the fourth boss in the game, and I couldn't proceed with that save file anymore. Mm-hmm. And like, I was like, I could start a new save file, but what guarantee would I have that I wouldn't run into something like this again? So it just completely ruined the game for me. It took years in order for me to get around to giving it a fair shake again. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. But I did kind of feel like, well, I guess it's my fault for buying an indie game at launch from an unknown developer, right? And like that sucks, because I want to be able to give like an indie game from an unknown developer a shot, mm-hmm. like at launch week, to like boost those sales, boost that profile, so they have a better shot of like getting a success. But right. like I do kind of feel like, well, I'm the idiot for taking a leap, you know, and that sucks.
Mm-hmm. That's why like I really applaud when a game like RE4 Remake comes out.
Yeah,
and I didn't experience one technical issue. The only thing I'll complain about is a little bit of texture popping here and there on cutscenes, mm-hmm. Like the facial textures and things. But I mean, you know, that's very small compared to what we've been discussing. And so, like, that game, even though Capcom is already a multi-million dollar company, mm-hmm. It's like, if you could afford it, go buy that game, you know, support that. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that was just a point I wanted to bring up when he said supporting developers, even if they're not, you know, indie.
Yeah.
You know, even the bigger companies, when they do something right, you know, I do try to support them.
Yeah.
But it's making, what's going on in the industry is making us more hesitant to go out and purchase things day one.
Yeah.
Like, we all knew RE4 Remake was a day one purchase. Mm-hmm. But imagine if it was super buggy, like, that would have hurt. They would have taken a hit on the next release.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? And so hopefully they start realizing that. Pre-order numbers just start plummeting based on things like Redfall and whatnot. And, mm-hmm. you know, who's going to thrive the most are, you know, PlayStation, Nintendo pre-orders, because their track record is a lot better than those third party, or in this case, Xbox and Bethesda Their track record is very tarnished, you know what I mean? Yeah. So
I feel like at the moment Capcom's got reputation to burn. Like, everything they've done on RE Engine has been super solid.
Yeah, Capcom's on the roll.
Mm-hmm.
But, CDPR is a good example of having reputation to burn and then burning it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
Like, they built up so much goodwill over the life cycle of Witcher 3.
Yep.
And now they got to build it back up again.
Yeah. So when they announced Witcher 1 Remake, for you personally, as a Witcher fan, it's day one. But if you're not really into the Witcher series, and you're like, oh, they released Cyberpunk... Remember how that did at launch?
Yeah.
We're going to wait. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the diehard Witcher fans are going to go and buy that game mm-hmm. right away. But it's just one of those things they're going to have to overcome.
What was I going to say? I just had it in my head.
Nintendo fans are lucky.
We are.
Relatively speaking.
Technically speaking.
Oh,
they have other curses.
I remember what I was going to say. Just like, even though this isn't necessarily limited to bugs, I also just feel like, the industry keeps kind of churning out some duds. Just games that get hyped and then released to, you know, kind of middling reviews. Like, I think actually Dead Island 2 is a good example of this. It had been years, you know, like that game went through development hell. I was actually reading about it in Game Informer when the issue came out, reading about its development and how it was troubled and how long fans of that game waited for the sequel. And, you know, it has this whole write up in Game Informer. It's super hyped. They're talking about how great it's going to be. The writer's talking about how much fun he's having playing the demo, and then it comes out to middling reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like, we get AAA stuff that's pretty good. But, you know, like, look at the Call of Duty franchise, right? Like, that continues to have problems, and, like, it went from this incredibly well-respected, loved franchise to it's kind of stuttering. It's having some problems. Even, like, yes, God of War and the last two have been, like, well-loved. But people also had some issues with that game. Or, like, the story is kind of what I'm getting at. And it's just, like... Or, like, what's that one that I've been having some fun with and that I playtested on the zombie game?
Days Gone.
That's another good example of, like, something that was super hyped. And even though I had a lot of fun with that game, like, it's admittedly not, like, mm-hmm. the best game ever.
Yeah.
And so I just feel like looking back on the history of the industry, there's just so many blockbusters that are frankly really hard to live up to, and I understand that, but it also just feels like you look at Forspoken, right? I mean, super hyped, everyone thought it was going to be fantastic, and then first trailer comes out with dialogue and everyone's like, this looks like shit. Mm-hmm. And it releases and it just bombs.
Yeah.
And so I'm just wondering, like, where... But then you look at the games that were doing fantastic this year. They're all remakes. You know, Metroid Prime, Dead Space.
Kirby.
And Resident Evil 4.
Mm-hmm.
I mean...
You know, to be fair, like, yeah. But both Wolong and Jedi Survivor are not remakes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Wolong...
Well, I think this speaks to a larger issue, which is there's less room to experiment now because development costs are so much higher for AAA productions. So you want to make a 3D game, you're talking about giant teams. And so that makes it so that you're going to be less willing as a developer or publisher or whatever to experiment, you know? So, like, even with Star Wars, like, it's based in the IP of Star Wars, so there's like some wiggle room there where it's like, yes, it's a new game, a new experience, but it has the safety net of being Star Wars. There's mm-hmm. going to be some people who just buy it on brand recognition alone. But that means something like a remake is safer because mm-hmm. it's like, hey, yes, you're going to invest a lot in development, but it's a proven name and game, so that gives you some leeway. And what you're starting to see is... the true experimentation comes from the smaller studios. But even then, you're not quite seeing experimentation on the level of, like, a AAA title, right? Like, a lot of the indie scene is still dominated with, like, 2D experiences, or less graphically, you know, rich or complicated experiences.
No, I get it. There's a lot of like pixel art, a lot of like roguelite or procedural elements that are used, a lot of like blah blah blah, like loot systems, and
so it's interesting. You know, you kind of wonder if we'll get to the point where as engines like Unreal Engine 5 and Unity become a little more widespread, and you know, if you start making it even easier to use the UIs for those, you might start to see a greater proliferation of like smaller studios where they're like, hey, you know, Unreal Engine's free. As long as we know how to use it, we could make our own, you know, 3D adventure game. And, you know, as the barrier gets lower to develop for those, maybe. But all I'm driving at is that this means, you know, you're going to have these buggy games coming from the bigger studios where they're a little more free to experiment because it's like, hey, Call of Duty. Everyone's going to buy Call of Duty. We can get away with this, this, and that not being at the level it should be. But so long as you don't break the game when it comes out, you'll keep getting away with it.
I feel like I don't have any faith that the proliferation of Unreal Engine 5 and Unity is going to ameliorate this problem at all. I think, like, we have had accessible game-making technologies going back to, like, Click and Play and Game Maker and a bunch of other things like that.
ZX Spectrum?
That is the name of a system. I don't know why you said that.
Well, you know, the old school, that British scene, all those guys coding in their bedrooms.
Like, the demo scene people were coders, right? That's different than, like, Click and Play or Game Maker, which are a little bit more plug-and-play. And more accessible to like hobbyists, like removing some of that technical barrier. Like I know my friend Derek, the guy who made Spelunky, he got started using Click and Play. He wasn't really like a coder first and foremost. He was designing using tools that helped with that lift. I think there's always going to be, and especially as budgets increase, tend to look for safe plays. But I think you've seen that throughout the history of video games. We know how many like middling mascot platformers there were in the 90s because that's what people saw as safe, right? Yeah. It's like, let's put Cool Spot in the game. Let's put Chester Cheetah in a game. There's you to tell me that Cool Spot is a great game.
Cool Spot's a great game.
You can agree with the general principle. Like I saw like them moving towards the microphones. Be like, they got to defend the honor of Cool Spot for the Super NES.
I get what you're saying. I just feel like there was a reason why you went right for Cool Spot.
It was the first thing that came to mind, but I know there's a Chester Cheetah game also similar. But like, yeah, anyhow, the point is that people are always going to look for the easiest way to get a return on their investment. Yeah. That might be more acute now that the investments are larger, but
yeah, I mean, I was actually surprised by, Arceus, you know, Pokemon Arceus,
that they were willing to go that far out on a limb.
Yeah. Because it was, I hadn't enjoyed Pokemon like that in years. And I spent quite a number of hours in that game. And, you know, it's not like, there are still some, you know, basic Pokemon elements in it, especially like the battling. But even the battling system, you know, had been upgraded a bit. But just the premise, this open world and traveling around it and your relationship with Pokemon and the way that you're interacting with them, it was refreshing. I was surprised that Nintendo was willing to go out on a limb like they did with Arceus. If we saw more of that, I think that would be really interesting. I don't know that we will see more of that, though. I think Arceus was an exception to the rule.
Yeah.
This is kind of a little bit off topic, but it popped in my head. You know, all of us at the table are fortunate enough to own both, or all three, I should say. Mm-hmm. You know, Nintendo, PS5 and series consoles, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, me personally, I'll play the first party PlayStation 5 games because I have access to them. I'll play them, but I primarily game third party and Xbox titles on the Series X. I love my Xbox. You know, I have hundreds of games on there, and as an Xbox fan, this whole situation. I'm using Redfall as an example a lot because it's the most recent. Mm-hmm. This is the Game Pass, the fear of Game Pass I had that I was just hoping wouldn't, you know, become a reality. But the reality is that Redfall dropped. It's part of the service, quote unquote. Sort of like, eh, it is what it is. But to me, it's like, I don't look at it that way. And a lot of other Xbox people don't look at it that way. They look at it as, Xbox has an exclusive coming out. Looks pretty dope. And then a month before releasing, these little, you know, issues with it are coming to light. The frame rate issue. And then once it releases, all this entire list of issues. But it's a Game Pass game. It's part of the subscription. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it gets almost a pass in some eyes. Mm-hmm. For me, it doesn't. And that's what I was fearful for, this whole subscription thing. Mm-hmm. And I hope it doesn't become the norm. And I hope they use this experience as that. It's like, oh, we got 25 million or however, whatever the count is, of people paying, you know, between 10 and 14 bucks a month. Mm-hmm. You know, we're getting paid. You know, if we release Redfall crappy, it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that really sucks. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily turn me off of Xbox completely, but, you know, they have an uphill battle with me and a lot of other consumers to gain their trust back. And this release of Starfield, a lot of stuff is riding on Starfield's release and performance for Xbox, in my opinion.
Yeah.
They have a lot in the pipeline, I believe, you know, between Hellblade, Avowed, and, you know, the studios that, you know, that they have acquired, you know, minus the Activision and Blizzard. But so I feel confident that they're not like going to go away. I mean, every generation of Xbox, it's been like, oh, this is the end. Xbox One is the end, you know. So
yeah.
I don't foresee that. That's a lot of media talk, I feel. But even as an Xbox fan, you can't sit here and deny that there's some major issues with what the hell they're doing with their whole platform. And they need to take some notes, I think, from how Sony's doing certain things. Sony's not perfect.
Yeah.
Like, not even close.
Yeah,
but, I mean, on the exclusive side, they're a lot better. You know.
Yeah, there's, like, I think, got to be some, I don't know, like, at what level it is or whatever, but obviously some management problems going on at Xbox for Redfall to release in the state that it's in. A number of somebodies at various points in the project should have, like, either got more funding for it or changed the scope of it or done something, because you don't get a game that performs like that when it's being properly supervised by the appropriate people, you know?
Yeah, it almost feels like they were so far in it, so deep into it, to abandon it, so they decided to just punt it at release. You know what I mean? Like, it is crazy. What it is.
Yeah.
Punt it. And I don't know, because the thing is, it was in development before Xbox purchased them, right? So obviously, because they've only been Bethesda and, like, Arcane and everything has been under Xbox for only what, like, two years,
something like that. Yeah,
so, and I'm right sure Redfall's been in development longer than that. So I don't know if it's, I mean, I've read articles that Xbox came in and wasn't happy with it. But again, this is media talk. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like Zach's saying, something went wrong.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because, like, speaking to Game Pass, and, you know, we talked about subscription services, I think, in the last episode. If you just look at subscription services as a whole, like, the exponential demand for entertainment that's been created by these services, because essentially you're now providing 24 hour a day access to movies, to music, to games. And if you think of, like, the traditional model of, like, you just watched cable or satellite and whatever was programmed would come on and then you would watch it. Now it's like, here's an entire season and of whatever show, and you can blast through it in a weekend. And it's like, okay, so I did, and now I want more. Where it would have been spread across weeks, right, and months. Games are in an interesting position because they're in that same, you know, paradigm of needing to provide constant entertainment like these other services do. But the creation process is so much slower compared to other mediums of entertainment. Because, like, with games, you talk about years for development. Whereas some, you know, shows are getting produced every single year. They come out regularly. You get months and months and months of them, right? With a game, it's like, okay, we're going to spend, you know, 3 years, maybe 4 years working on this game. And in some cases, it'll provide, I mean, I don't know, what, 30 hours of content? 40 hours? If it's an RPG, maybe you're talking, like, over 100 hours. But then it's like, if it fails and you don't want to play that game, it just sits there. And what do? And like, Microsoft is, I think, like, of all the services that are out there, theirs is the most aggressive in terms of giving you stuff to play. And if you're going to show up with games that are just effed, like, that's really not good. So, like, Redfall's failure, I mean, that's one less thing in your catalog to entice people.
Yeah.
Especially when you've been sitting and looking at the catalog and you're like, well, when's something new coming? And something new that's worthwhile, you know, not just like some random Xbox 360 game that they happen to get the rights to and then throw on there. Like,
and for them to pump like the expectation level for this game so high, because I've seen more advertisement for this game than a lot of other, mm-hmm. you know, titles that have released. So that just adds to Robert's point. It's like my hype level and a lot of other people's hype level for this game was pretty high.
Yeah.
And that just is a gut punch when it just releases like that. It's like, you know, when we were kids, we were super hyped for, you know, the next Zelda game, and it was just shit, you know. Maybe not to that degree, but, yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I agree.
You guys talking about Skyward?
I mean, well.
So, you know, again, glitches. I'm assuming one of the other things we want to talk about is, like, what, like maybe some of the good stuff that come from glitches? There's a lot of memorable things attached to glitches, right? I mean, what is it? Minus World in the first Mario is probably one of the most prominent.
Yeah. And even going like that, what I was talking about with like Final Fantasy VI mm-hmm. on the Super Nintendo, like one of the big differences, I think the big difference between the 1.0 and 1.1 versions is that in the 1.0 version, you know, there's like 14 different playable characters in that game. One of them is a painter. And she has the, like, in-battle ability to sketch the enemy. And what that means is she does, like, one of the moves that the enemy knows to the enemies. But the way the game is originally coded, it doesn't know how to handle how to sketch an invisible enemy. And if you do that, it messes up your entire inventory. But what messing it up means is changes everything to random items, including things that you don't have yet, like super strong in-game items. So you can get like 20 copies of the strongest sword in the game as a result of sketching an invisible enemy.
Mm-hmm. Reminds me of the unknown number or whatever in mm-hmm. Pokemon Yellow, yeah. where you get like 99 rare candies or
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like Majora's Mask, you can, roam around the overworld as the Fierce Deity.
Whole thing's a glitch.
Yeah.
Like, you have to do the conveyor belt but and you can't, switch the mask
But
in.
You can't talk to anyone after you become the Fierce mm-hmm. Deity. Otherwise, it'll freeze the game, and then you have to turn it off. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of, I think, a good example of what Robert's talking about, where it's like, it's something neat and it's something cool that actually does add something to the game, but unfortunately also can break the game.
And speedruns are powered by a bunch of this nonsense.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
If you
yeah.
watch speedruns of like Mega Man games or a bunch of other like old side scrollers, there's a lot of stuff where it, like, there are techniques to force yourself into a wall so that the game tries to resolve that by shooting you like a laser beam mm-hmm. 20 miles down until it finds some empty space to put your character into. Mm-hmm. And you can skip like entire stages that way, which is not how I would play a game normally, but it's cool that like a lot of the more advanced speedrun techniques are dependent on weird, sometimes hardware specific glitches.
Yeah. And like glitches now, I mean, of course there's going to be funny ones. Like, I think I saw one of the PC version of Last of Us Part 1 mm-hmm. at launch. Mm-hmm. It's like, they're having a serious ass conversation, and in the background you see Ellie spinning on her head. She's like spinning. So like, and then like Redfall, like the characters are in the ground and they're trying to shoot, and you just see question marks over their head, and she's in the cement. So, I mean, that goes for funny content.
Yeah,
right?
Like, yeah. I remember a few years ago, one of the Assassin's Creed games came out. This was back in like, you know, whatever, 2014, 2015.
Yeah.
And there was like the screenshots of what was supposed to be, I think, like a romantic scene. Mm-hmm. And the characters' faces, like facial features, did not render. And so it was just like their skulls with like their eyes and I think their brains. And it
wasn't their skull. It was just eyeball.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Teeth.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, eyeball, teeth. I just remember the eyeballs in particular.
And then, like, nothing, and then the hood.
Yeah, and it was really creepy looking. But that made for some good humor.
Well, I mean, the memorability of some of the glitches, look at the remake of Ocarina of Time. They made sure to include some of the glitches, like, intentionally. Like, when Link, you light all the torches in the, was it the Goron, what's it called, Goron City or whatever? Uh-huh. and there's that giant urn that's like in the center, and when it starts to, there's like a basically Link spins in conjunction with something else,
it starts spinning and he because Link's head tracks like what he's focused on, mm-hmm. because it's spinning, his character model is standing in place spinning,
but
because,
just in the cutscene, right?
Because his head is trying to keep track of the spinning.
But I thought
urn.
That's intentional.
No, it's a glitch, they
make sure to include it.
Yeah, he's not supposed to just spin in place like he's on a dais, you know.
It's interesting because like we're talking about glitches earlier from that kind of consumer standpoint of don't F me over and waste my money and time. But then glitches have also just been a huge traditional part of gaming from the entire sub-genre of speedrunning to just quirks from when you were playing, you know, like
competitive maybe, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Little things competitively that pop up. I mean, they're interesting. It's part of the fun of the medium, I think. I think I prefer the grittiness of games, you know, in terms of not being perfect. It's like, you know, you get a Hollywood movie, you know, like Game of Thrones, maybe there's accidentally a Starbucks cup on a table, right? Or Downton Abbey, the water bottle on the mountain place and those and the mantle place and those photos. Like, but for the most part, those productions are, they tend to be more smooth and perfect, right? You get a movie or even a book, maybe there's a typo, but for the most part, everything's like perfect. Games, always some weirdness. Mm-hmm. And that's how, like, you know you're playing a game. And it's part of what makes it fun.
Old games, too. Like
especially old.
Things like music notes that'll cut out mm-hmm. because it can't handle both the sound effect and the music note at the same time. So you'll get, like, little breaks in the music.
That's not a glitch. That's just like, well, what can you do?
I agree with that, like, what Robert was saying. Yeah. The only thing is that these that we speak of are anomalies, like, in a game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But a game full of glitches, like what we're talking about now, like
entirely
at launch,
different. It's unacceptable.
It's a lot different.
It's unacceptable. Yeah. I mean,
it'd still be amusing if you have the right state of mind, like Cyberpunk being full of T poses.
Yeah. I mean, I think just closing thoughts here. Like I said earlier, the consumer is in a tough place because, like I said before, it's very hard for us to take a stand because at least not that I can think of, there might be some out there, but there really aren't, you know, the majority of developers are not like a single IP dev. It's not like you can just say, I'm not going to, you know, play any, I don't know, Nintendo games anymore because this game really ticked me off or whatever. Even though Nintendo's a bad example of that because they're usually pretty good. And because of that, I feel like the consumer has less power when we're talking about the gaming industry than other consumer products. And I don't really know where we go from here other than just almost like having to just swallow our pride and take it. And I feel, as someone who doesn't like being put in that position, that's hard for me to accept, to just kind of have to accept, like, this is the norm of gaming now. Games are going to get hyped and like half of them are going to be turds at launch. That's hard for me to accept.
I have a hard time judging people for doing things like review bombing or throwing tantrums online just because there aren't that many ways to give feedback to the system. Like, if a company is getting money at some level, they're not going to care. Mm-hmm. If you can't like damage the reputation or make it hard for them to make money, they're not going to care. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Like, obviously, the like perfect answer here is just don't buy things from companies that have shown themselves to be untrustworthy in this fashion, right? Just like never buy another CDPR game, and also never buy another Respawn game, and also never buy another Arcane game. And you get to a point where it's not really realistic.
Yeah.
Because, and not just because of the number, like the scope of this problem, like how widespread it is, but like, we play games because we love games. Like you find a game you love and you play it for 30 hours, 50 hours, what, right? Like if you, the part of the reason that publishers can get away with this is because we, in playing games, demonstrate so much love for the activity and for these specific games that it's easy to take advantage of us, basically, because we're not willing to walk away.
Well, it's complicated too by the fact that staff members come and go. So people that resulted in a crappy game might be gone by the time they're working on the next game. Mm-hmm. There's teams within companies that work on titles. I mean, look at Nintendo alone, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the different divisions that work on the different games.
Yeah.
So it's like, it makes it challenging to stand up to that system, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it also, well, I mean, like, we're doing our own podcast here. I kind of pride Nintendo, Joe, too, in that, you know, we're honest with how we feel about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that a lot of people have started to come to question, too, just, like, the honesty that they're getting from the more mainstream outlets that they go to for coverage, you know, whether it's IGN or GameSpot or Kotaku or whoever, where you're just like, well, you know, the term that some people will use is like access media, right? Like they get access. Like you, the average person, will not get a review copy of Tears of the Kingdom. You're not going to get it ahead of release. You're never going to get it. But IGN will. And, you know, you do kind of look sometimes at coverage and reviews and you question what you're seeing because you're just like, well, you know, like some of these complaints are strange or they don't seem to be focused on the game. Or, you know, you just wonder, it's like, how honest is it when there's this clear relationship between them getting copies and wanting to talk and on,
mm-hmm.
That's why I think it's important that you have these smaller outlets, like what we're putting together, stuff you see on YouTube, where it's just regular people talking and giving their opinions. And in some ways it feels more trustworthy because it's like, well, they're just a bunch of nobodies. They're not getting any kind of kickback to butter up something.
Well, they are, but what they're buttering up is their audience.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And you know, it sucks because you want to be able to trust these outlets, and that kind of lets you down. And also, the frustration that I get is when you're seeing studios try to dismiss the fans. You know, like they talk about fantagonism, right? Where it's like, oh, that's just a bunch of so-and-sos that are like either review bombing or saying that this is good or this is bad. And they'll latch on to some thing that they try to use as a way to scapegoat the negativity. Like, oh, it's an ism that they don't like. And then that's why they don't like this game. And it's like, no, you're blanketing what a large chunk of people are saying and trying to like sweep it under the rug. And that is also problematic, you know. And anyway, I think I went a little tangent there, but...
Very good. I think if you're able to hang it up at launch, if you're able to just fight the urge to buy certain games at launch, I think that's probably the best route
to
take.
I've bought more new games this year than I can remember ever doing. Just, you know, a bunch over and over. Dead Space bought when it came out. Wolong bought when it came out. Resident Evil 4, Jedi Survivor, just over and over. I don't usually do that. I usually mix in a lot more retro games, things in my backlog, whatever. And that does give you time to... let any problems like this mostly sort themselves out.
Yeah, this is true.
Especially if you play mostly single player games like I do. You don't have to worry about being part of like the big multiplayer player count. Mm-hmm. Boom. So play old games.
I've got that covered.
Well, yeah. You play them slowly enough that they become old games by the time you get halfway through them. I guess I would just say... thank you for listening.
Yeah, that was good.
Mm-hmm.
This has been 7 minutes.
Peace out.
Give or take.
Peace.